Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this episode of AAEM Social Emergency Medicine Grassroots Podcast. I'm very excited today to be joined today by Dr. Annalise DeWolf in this podcast where we are highlighting a ED-based community violence interruption team. Just a little bit about Dr. DeWolf, but I am Jordan Bond. I'm one of the vice chairs of AAEM Social EM Committee. So I'm happy to be here and happy to be able to let you guys all know about this great programming and having the chance to get on this podcast with a dear friend, mentor, and colleague. Dr. Annalise DeWolf, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into this work, and how you got here today?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me, Jordan. Wonderful to hear and see you in this way. I came to New Orleans for medical school, oh my God, almost 20 years ago. And was actually 20 whole years ago. I came to New Orleans 20 years ago. I'm just realizing the time. Got really suckered into New Orleans life, given I was here during Hurricane Katrina, and really became really emotionally involved in what it means to be part of a community and part of building a community. Decided to stick around here for residency and got to work with some of the violence intervention professionals who were coming through the emergency department. At that time, people were coming in through different models, ceasefire, cure violence, and they continued to over many years. And I worked with them to facilitate making that work, doing the logistics of troubleshooting when and external entities are trying to come in and engage with families that can families and patients that can there can be some logistic challenges to that. So really worked on logistics with them for quite a while. I ended up doing my fellowship in international emergency medicine that included an MPH where I focused on community health. And so it all went together, that building community, my desire to strengthen the capacity that exists both here and abroad. And as we saw, I think a lot of cities have this issue where when you have new leadership in mayoral administrations, you end up having kind of mission shift, mission drift, different funding availability. And we saw just like a couple different iterations of violence programs rise and fall during these years. The last time that things ended was during the pandemic, when we stopped having people coming into the hospital regularly. And that was pretty heartbreaking because we saw As soon as the restrictions were lifted, we saw that violence really went up, and we saw that all over the country, but it was very bad in New Orleans, and the timing was unfortunate to not have these programs in place. We were lucky to have allies in the health department and lucky to have allies in hospital administration that we were able to ultimately house a violence intervention program at the hospital. And the way that works is a little bit different than some other hospitals. Because we had this ongoing experience with having people come through the emergency department, we both at the health department as well as in the hospital really felt like there's a role for emergency medicine as being the facilitators of this and having starting that engagement with survivors of gunshot wounds and their families as soon as they come in and as soon as they've been shot. So we started this program. It's a combination of violence interrupter and violence intervention specialist model. And that's housed under the Trauma Recovery Center and together with our collaborators who are trauma psychologists. So I think there's a couple ways in which it differs from the many of the other models that are out there, but trying to take advantage of some of the lessons learned from many of these different programs out there.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think in a way you answered this, but you mentioned before ceasefire and cure violence and the many kind of like iterations of the programming that have been in the city. Mm-hmm. What, if any, have you taken from those prior models and how did that kind of help shape your formation as you worked with your different, you know, hospital partners, health department and partnerships to develop this program?
So I think one of the big things that was important for re-envisioning this was to harness the expertise of the people who've been on the ground this whole time. So we're really lucky that one of the original ceasefire folks is one of our advisors and partners in this, and really trying to harness that ability to intervene and communicate and read the room and hear what is not being said. I think all of those things are lessons that we learned early on and that I keep learning in terms of people's risk for retaliation, for further injury. I think early on, I would sometimes try to give people my doctor advice about not getting shot again. And it was just ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And I had no idea how to even package that in a way that was palatable and just didn't sound all wrong.
No, I think it's important because as emergency medicine physicians, we are trying to intervene, and ultimately, we don't want to see these patients shot again in our emergency department. So I think it comes from a great place, but it's a great perspective. And you mentioned having that credible messenger from the community that also speaks the language and is able to say, hey, look, I don't need to hear that right now. This is actually what I need this time, bedside. And so often I think we're doing some great thing and it just ultimately makes us feel good when we leave, but then we don't even understand if or what damage we may have imposed that doing that at that time. So I think that's great that you kind of mentioned that, and that using that trauma-informed model and like approach, which a lot of new and now I think in the interruption world we're starting to do and get, but I think it's just important to have that lead, right? And be like at the face and front of your model. You mentioned already, but can you just tell us about the main targeted patient population and just a little bit of the logistics of the program? So someone comes in, they're shot, like what from there happens and how are your interventionists or your interrupters involved at that point?
Yeah. So if somebody gets shot, they come to University Medical Center if they're older than 14. And that's the one trauma center for adults in the hospital, in the city. If somebody gets shot, they either come via EMS or walk up or drop off. They come into the emergency department. That resuscitation happens. That person either survives or does not. If they don't survive, the provider, the physician who's working with that family will go and notify the family and bring a violence interrupter with them to do that notification or get them involved soon after that notification. And the interrupters will work to support the family, often like gather them up off the ground and deal with that acute grief reaction, and also listen for the retaliatory language and really try to take advantage of that moment of being there to calm those sentiments and try to help people think through consequences of or potential consequences of retaliation. And then also provide resources for the trauma recovery center that provides bereavement services after traumatic injury. And so that's a really helpful resource that they can bring when they're there. That is usually pretty brief because the families aren't really able to stay in the hospital for a very long time due to security and other reasons. If the individual survives, when they have the ability to engage with interrupters, the interrupters will see them at the bedside. So they may go through their scans and their x-rays and then be available for talking. They may go straight to the operating room. They may not be able to engage with the interrupters until after they're extubated. It depends on the clinical situation, but the interrupters come, engage with the patient and engage with their families, tell them about the program, tell them about their role. And they really, while they're in the hospital, offer a lot of emotional support to everybody. And that has been this kind of, we didn't realize how much people were needing that and how much they would value that. And people will just sit there and say, I don't want to talk. And then they'll be like, can I sit with you for a minute? And then before you know it, they're telling all their backstory and very New Orleans style chatties, expressing all the things that are going on. Once they start to introduce the idea of the violence intervention program, long-term piece, and once the survivor of the gunshot wound is amenable to it, they get a violence intervention specialist involved in their care. So if the situation allows and they're in the hospital, we try to facilitate having bedside handoffs that the violence interrupter introduces the specialist with whom the survivor will be working over time. And then that specialist does a strengths-based, case management-based violence reduction plan with that survivor. And so that's outpatient. that's housed in the Trauma Recovery Center, which does m mental health and like trauma mental health care. But what they do is really try to elicit what are your needs and what are your strengths and what do you envision for your future and how do we help you get there? With the idea that if people can explore, express, and make headway towards their goals, that will reduce their risk of getting shot again in the future.
Yeah. So I think it's great because what I'm hearing is it's more than just like that bedside. And I think the bedside first approach is very important, that but from then it's this continued relationship that they're having where they can build with someone that they trust that can go through the things of, okay, what places you at highest risk, or what are the things that we can play onto your strengths, or like things that we can help with resource wise. So I think that's very important that you guys are taking that holistic approach while also in the background doing that through the Trauma Recovery Center. They can get introduced to the things that kind of help with mental health and PTSD and all the things that come with that. So I think that's great. I know that this
Yeah,
is.
I was just going to say that I don't want to understate the importance of it being housed under the Trauma Recovery Center, because I think one thing we see for sure in New Orleans post-Katrina, post all this exposure to community violence, and with all this just like historic inequity that continues through today, that there's people are carrying around a lot of trauma, and that if we don't address that, that won't go away. And we know that stress responses make people more likely to carry a gun, to pull a trigger. And we know that treating the mental health piece alone can act as a violence intervention. So we really try to couple those together, not necessarily, certainly not like shoving mental health care down people's throats, but making that referral easy and destigmatizing that and trying to make sure that's part of what we address in our evaluation.
And just more so just normalizing that too, like with the stigma that goes with that, being that, hey, look, you came in, you got your blood pressure checked. All right, great. Now mental health is also a part of like our wellness and checking on yourself and being at your best optimal health. It's so important. So this program, how long have you guys been up and running? And
We started in December.
woo!
Ooh. So we're still working out a lot of kinks, but we did 2 weeks of intensive training with our team. Our team was the violence intervention program, the new trauma recovery center staff, and our partner organization, Ubuntu Village, who has peace ambassadors doing the community-based work in partnership with us, so that we're all sharing the same language. It was all very steeped in trauma-informed care, and we all wanted to make sure we were all getting the same perspective in how we reach out to members of our community.
And I know that this is very new, but it seems like from what I've heard that you guys have done such a tremendous amount of work in such a short period of time. What are some current like successes or positive outcomes currently that you've seen in the work that you've done of how you guys have been able to intervene and provide care and like some positives that you guys maybe could share?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I was expecting a fair amount of resistance from people. We were so hesitant to barge into people's rooms, and we know that's a vulnerable state when you've just been shot. And we were really mindful of how we enter patients' rooms and how we acknowledge the trauma that they've gone through. But I was really surprised by how much people are so thankful to have that support and how they seeing somebody that they identify with. It's New Orleans, so half the time people know each other already. But even if they don't, how much they will remember the name of the interrupter that came to the room and ask about them over time and really appreciate that support. So I think that was like the biggest surprise piece of success. I think the other thing I didn't realize, and I think part of that is just my blind spots, and part of that is me not like internalizing. We break bad news all the time, and we hear people say, "Oh, I have to go and take care of that." But I never felt empowered to be like, "No, you should really not retaliate." Like, I'm the doctor giving the bad news. I didn't never felt like that was my space that I could I engage in. And now there's people who do that, and all the time. I think I've just anecdotally been told probably almost 10 different times that people have been fully planning to go retaliate, and they have engaged with a member of our staff and decided not to. So that's, we had a woman the other day come to the trauma recovery center to the office and find her violence intervention specialist and say, I'm feeling really stressed out. I really want to shoot this person. And thankfully, Shakita was there to like just sit with her and talk her out of it. So that's in the outpatient setting, but also routinely with the interrupters. And they have the credibility and the empathy to really make those connections, and people take them seriously. So that's been really heartwarming to see that it.
Well, that's powerful. You mentioned before other partners that you guys have worked with to get to this point, the trauma recovery center, the hospital, and the health admin. What are any other kind of multidisciplinary connections that you guys have made with different like nonprofits or different organizations to do the work that you guys are currently doing in the hospital?
I think, first of all, in the hospital, this would never work with just one service involved because it touches everywhere. It touches the clinics, it touches the surgical floors, it touches the emergency department. And so I'm seeing that it's important to have an emergency medicine person be part of that because otherwise people don't have a clue what's actually happening in the emergency department. I'm seeing that surgeons are important to figure out how things work up there, and then administrative and psychology and case management, like all these different services are involved. And that would just not, none of this is just one discipline. I think outside of the hospital, we are working closely, obviously, with the New Orleans Health Department since they're our funder and we're reporting to them and we're collaborating with them and we're trying to really build out this violence intervention ecosystem. Ubuntu Village is our partner in Not Crime, who is really, they've been this like guiding light, I think, really very practical and very community needs based and helps to bring the conversation back to what's important, and which is how are we going to help communities in trouble and how are we going to build the resources to get to decrease the risk of people being lost in this. It's more than that. There's also the Office of Criminal Justice Coordination. There's all these different advocacy groups and NGOs, and we're looking at filling people's housing needs. So I was thankful to be able to call somebody at Grace at the Greenlight, who's one of the advocacy organizations who works with homeless people, get somebody to rehab in Texas because we were able to coordinate and put the time and effort into getting the resources to get people to where they need to be. Still building some of those housing resources where we worked with the homeless, what is the name of that?
For the city
Home
manager
officer.
strategic office of unhoused, yeah.
Yes, that.
It's a long name. But yeah.
And then the mayor's office with the directing strategic initiatives has been super helpful because if there's a challenge, and I don't know how things work in bureaucracy, it's really helpful to have people that you can just call who will clarify, because there's a lot of layers of administration in all of these worlds that are tricky to work through.
Yes. And speaking of tricky, what are some of the barriers that you faced in starting this program?
So the longest, I think we've made this
Just a
reference to,
couple.
I know we talk about the institution with the capital I that's like a little bit resistant to change, and that everything has to go through many layers of review and acceptance. Just getting a consent form is feels like an act of Congress. But I think once you know the right people, it's much easier to get that done. Once you get past like middle management, can I say that? There are a lot of layers of no before you can finally get to people who will talk to you and say, actually, yeah, let's do this. But really, it's much easier to get to yes if it's if things are funded. So I think the funding is the key, and that we have funding for a few years. We need a lot more funding. Right now, we have enough funding for a bare bones skeleton crew to cover 24/7 in the hospital. But we're seeing that we need more than that, and that maybe it's not okay to have people day in and day out dealing with people's tragedy without building in additional support and getting people doubled up so that they can support each other and peer mentor. I think the biggest issue right now, too, is we have funding for the staff. We don't have funding to get people the things that they need to get them out of the situation. So we can use the resources, we can get job training, we can get housing assistance, but a lot of that stuff takes a lot of time to get it in place. And much like everywhere in the country, it feels affordable housing is really difficult. And sometimes people just need to get out of town to get away from the conflict. And so we're working on that stuff, trying to figure out, can we have partnerships with other cities? Are there ways that we can get people doing job training out of town, like on-site stuff? Are there options that involve housing? People are shot, so that's not always easy to go. You might need to stay local for a while. I wish we had a big apartment building that was full of fresh sunlight and plants and a healing environment, and people could feel, but that's not where we're at right now. So we're getting there. I
Goals.
think last barrier, which is also related to funding, is that we know that there's evidence behind getting people to participate in violence intervention programs with a stipend. It's very hard to ask people to change their worldview and make all these positive choices when they are struggling to get food on the table or keep their lights on. And that's a very real reality for people. And there's studies that show that just therapy isn't going to do it, or just a life coach isn't going to do it. But if you put that together with the ability to survive financially, that makes it a much bigger impact. But that's a tough one. That's a tough ask for funders. It's tough to say, please give us a lot of money for this thing that's just to get people to participate in the program.
And the positive impact, but I think it's all about at the end of the day being able to show that with numbers and being able to communicate that in the language that they hear of what's going to make them want to donate all that money. So I think that's also
Yeah, and
difficult.
the evidence, it's not like there's this
Readily available, yeah, just in your face.
evidence base. We were just talking about that earlier today, that the research on gun violence just hasn't been happening until recently. And so now everybody's rushing to get information and look at all these different ways of looking at things. But we have to do things that are based on preliminary evidence.
Right. What are, and this may be too early, but what are some of your future goals of where you hope to take this program? And like, where do you see this program in maybe 2 to 3 years?
So I think I want to continue to strengthen the staff. That's both through professional development and advancement opportunities. I think there it'd be nice to have this be a long-term path to like your career. And that's a tough one nationally, just because people are exposed to a lot. So they need to have a livable wage, something that's competitive with other professional jobs. That makes them want to stay and have power in these in decisions about what happens with the program. So I think that's something we really need to think about now and continue to build. I think we obviously need to invest in those relationships and referrals and telling the team, I want to know who the person is who you're going to call when you know somebody's about to be discharged. Which is always on a Friday night or Saturday morning, somewhere when nobody's at the office. I want to know who we're going to call to get them in a house like Saturday afternoon. That we're just not there yet. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to build those that resource bank. And I'm hopeful that we'll have the money to be able to solve a problem over a weekend and then deal with what we have to deal with on Monday. And I'm hopeful that we'll have the funding to have participation stipends.
Oh, that's amazing. So all of our listeners out here are wondering, man, this sounds like a lot of work. It sounds like a lot of challenges and barriers. If you're looking to start something like this, where is a place to start?
So I think there's some literature out there about ways to approach this. I think Javi has a pretty good guide to how to start thinking about this with that's the Health Alliance for Violence Interventions. You have to start with buy-in. That is in the community. There has to be this sense of urgency to solve this. And that's within the hospital, which is a tough sell to for-profit institutions. Even if they're academic and nonprofit-y, I feel like there's always a bottom line to contend with. But if you have champions, it's amazing what you can get done. There is more funding now than there used to be. So I think if you can collaborate with people who can work with you, that you're not carrying the load all by yourself, then you have a much better chance, because otherwise you're going to hit your wall and burn out and not be able to keep maintaining. Yeah. So I think relationships, and then relationships with people in the community, the people who keep inspiring you and keep reminding you of why the work matters, is the way to be able to sustain.
Right. Yeah, that's so important. I think it's amazing all that the work that you've done. I know that this is years in the making, but it just speaks to your dedication to this effort. And I think it's amazing. And I hope that a lot of our listeners today will be able to learn from this and hopefully be inspired by this and realizing that this too can be a reality at their institutions, out of their emergency departments, and how impactful these services can be, and that as emergency medicine providers, we should be the ones, we can be the ones that are providing this service to our patient population. So I think that's amazing. Before we close, is there any other things that you'd like to provide or information for our listeners?
I think the thing that I would just say too, when thinking about this work, is I think sometimes as ER doctors, we separate ourselves from our patients, and that's this like very natural self-protective way to go through this often traumatizing workplace. And to think, oh, this happened to people because maybe they did something bad, or this happened to them because they're like in the game or whatever. And I think when we do that, it's a disservice to all of us. It chips away at our well-being, and obviously will impact the way that we treat our patients. And so I think the thing that has been really helpful is to ground the work in looking at the societal factors that have caused this to be what we're dealing with right now, this epidemic of gun violence in our city and our country. And I think if we can do that from a place of empathy and feel passionate about writing that, I think that your life will be better and your patients will be better.
For sure.
So even if you're not starting a program and like running uphill both ways to do that, I think just that acknowledgement of what our people are going through can help people's experience
Right.
greatly.
It's definitely important. Thank you, Dr. DeWolf. I appreciate you
You're
so much
welcome.
for taking time out of your very busy schedule to educate our listeners on what it is that you're doing here in New Orleans. I think it's amazing. There are definitely other institutions that are doing this, and hopefully this can serve as a way to ignite others to do the same, or for those that are trying to continue their efforts. So thank you so much. And to
Yeah,
our
no
listeners, thank
problem.
you so much for joining us. We appreciate you guys.
Thanks.